Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will alight and experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artists First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Kenora, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tonight's Crime Beat broadcast presents Richard Moody, co-author of The Charmer. Richard Moody will discuss the true story of Robert Reldon, rapist, murderer, and millionaire, and the woman who fell in love with this guy, the victim to his allure. It's going to be a fascinating show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director, publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in international shipping business, where he's the contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out this year, and another book is coming out this summer about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie.
Well, thanks for that promo. Like I said, you're getting better at that all the time. Our book is almost sold out. It'll be coming out in e-book form later in the fall. Just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there from around the world, that's around the globe, for tuning into Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and a couple not so positive, but like I say, we'll take the good and the bad. We're averaging over 140,000 listeners every week now from more than 100 countries around the world, and that's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artists First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making this show possible. Well, Ronnie, now here's this week's mailbag. This one's from Courtney of South Florida, who writes, "Your guests, Allison Statman and Bree Tate, gave me a better understanding of the Sharon Tate family. I enjoyed hearing about their guest for victims' rights since the death of Sharon Tate almost 43 years ago. Their book, Restless Souls, shows that they are still struggling with the horrific and senseless murders by the Manson family." Now, this one is from Ole. That's Ole of Oslo, Norway. Ole writes, "Anders Breivik is only the tip of the iceberg here in Norway. There are a lot of people who think just like this monster who massacred 77 people. Of course, they wouldn't go out there and do what Breivik did, but to have the same ideology is scary enough. I also admire Dr. Stone for providing his in-depth insights on this terrible event that happened in our country. It'll never be forgotten." Hey, great comments, Ronnie. Your remarks, please.
Yeah, it's really it was kind of really weird. We went did a great show last week. We had Dr. Stone and the Tate family on. Went to bed, woke up, and to hear the news about James Holmes and the mass murder, and in Colorado, in Aurora, Colorado. The good news, we're going to have Dr. Stone back on in September once the smoke clears on this case and there's a little perspective to talk about James Holme and give his take on who he is and profile about why he did what he did and maybe some suggestions on how something like horrible like this could be prevented. And of course, the Tate family, they're real survivors. They've been dealing with the Manson monster family for over 40 years, and they're commendable for their work on behalf of victims' rights. And so they're survivors, and I think they're doing well. And the book is great. I recommend the book to anybody out there that's interested in that story.
It's a great read. Right. As long as Manson's still alive, but it's still going to be a craw in their.
We can't get rid of him. He's like a cockroach. You can't.
That's right. He's going to be around. I'll tell you for a long time. But
right.
Anyway, they're really dealing with the events
right.
that happened. Almost five decades,
right.
decades ago. Now, Ronnie, as you know. Let's get what's happening next week. Just before we get into the other segment,
right? We have a command appearance by Howard Campbell, who's going to be talking about his book, The Drug War Zone: Frontline Dispatches from the Street of El Paso and Juarez. And we've talked about the Mexican drug war, and it just seems to be getting worse. And Howard Campbell is one of the leading experts on that subject, so he's going to provide real perspective on it. And we're looking forward to that show.
Yeah. Well, you know what? He's coming back again. This is a command performance, and the show that he did was a great show. So we really urge our audience to tune in. Well, Ronnie, tell us what you've been up to, and tell us what you'll be doing in the next few days.
Well, we're working away. I got all these projects going, but we had some good news today. Our Matthews documentary is going to get on national TV. We're signing a contract with a channel, with a national. I won't mention the channel yet, but it's because the contract hasn't been signed. But we're going to be working out a deal with them, and it's going to be on national TV. So that's exciting news. And of course, we're working on Ike. The movie project continues. The publishing company, we've got a couple of books coming out in the next couple of weeks. So I suggest anybody want to keep up, go to strategicmediabooks.com. That's strategicmediabooks.com. Willie?
Yeah, way to go, Ronnie. Good luck on that side of it. You're going to be up there with the best of them, let me tell you.
Up there with the stars, right?
You bet. You should be up here in Kenora with Mel Gibson. Never mind.
I like to punch him out. I was in Kenora one time for about 2 months. It's one of the roughest. It's like a frontier town. You have to fight yourself, way out of the bars up there. So watch yourself tonight. Okay?
Well, I'm well protected. I'm well protected. My wife's with me, so she's going to protect me. Anyway,
I know your wife, and she did a good job of that.
Good for you. Hey, as you know, the Beat the Crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. A rap sheet features a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. And crime news you might have missed. Now here's this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, July 22nd, 2012, Washington, D.C. U.S. drug fight turns to Africa. Hey, Ronnie, in a significant expansion of war on drugs, the United States has begun training an elite unit of counter-narcotics police in Ghana and planning similar units in Nigeria and Kenya. Hey, Ronnie, Africa, man, that's a new angle. Hey, let's take on this.
Yeah, war on drugs screwed up the Western Hemisphere. Let's move across the big pond, right, and and screw up Africa. I'm telling you, it's unbelievable. You know, the military's downsizing in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're looking for new missions. That's what's happening here. To justify all the money we're spending on the military. But it's a total waste of money, and it's totally ineffective. An example of the failed war on drugs, Willie.
Yeah, it's just snowballing all over the world. I mean, they should legalize this stuff, and that'll control everything.
Right, They never learn. They just keep making the same mistakes over the last 30 to 40 years.
That's right. It's a sad commentary. Now, here's our second rap sheet item. Dateline, July 17th, 2012. Oklahoma City. Man shoots own genitals, goes to jail. Hey, Ronnie, a felon was arrested in Oklahoma City for possession of a firearm after he told police he shot himself in the genitals. Hey, well, Ronnie, I tell you, this one hurts. Any wisecrack items on remarks on this one, buddy?
I thought this was supposed to be useful news, news that our listeners. You know,
like I said, it's a crime news you might have missed.
That's true. Wow. But I'll tell you what, usually we would say something like, we got him by the balls, but this guy got to say he got himself by the balls, right, on this sort of thing. And I'm telling you, you know, we're not going to challenge his manhood if he goes in the bedroom with a woman and has to say, "Be gentle with me, dear."
I'll tell you, like I said, it hurts, man.
Yeah, anyway. he's a poster boy for the gun control crowd, right? Too dumb to own a gun.
They should put him on every billboard in the United States. On every
We can't make this up, Willie. We can't make this up.
That's for sure. Well, Ronnie. Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is Mr. Richard Moody, co-author of The Charmer. Richard Moody will discuss the life of Robert Reldin, rapist, murderer, and millionaire. You know, Vincent Bugliosi, Charles Manson's prosecutor and author of Helter Skelter, calls The Charmer one of the best in-depth examinations of the criminal mind he has ever read. Richard Moody spent 19 years as a successful trial prosecutor, and along with fellow prosecutor Charles Buckley, they have written a turn pager of a book. Richard Moody is a former Navy pilot, teacher of writing, American government, politics, and criminal justice. It's going to be a great show. You want one on this one? Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Richard Moody.
Thank you very much, Ron.
We're sorry that Charles can't be with us on this show, but I know we'll have a good show talking about this fascinating book. And I have to start off, as a now jealous writer, how did you get Vincent Bugliosi to write a review like that? My God, you know, his book on Manson is the best-selling true crime book of all time, and he's, you know, right up there in the top true crime writers.
Absolutely, and we got it by asking. Charles and I had a little bit of an edge in that we were both former career prosecutors. So
right.
What I did was I tracked down an address for Vince Bugliosi on the Internet and sent him a letter asking if he would be willing to read a draft of the book and sort of playing on the loyalty that prosecutors have for one another.
Right.
And I was absolutely astonished when one evening I was visiting my mother in Florida and I got a phone call and he said, "Richard, this is Vince Bugliosi." And we had a wonderful chat for about an hour. He gave me lots of pointers. This was before the book was finished, but I ended up sending him a draft and he very, very graciously gave us that wonderful blurb that we put on the cover of the book, as anyone would.
Right, and you know, it shows you what a true gentleman this guy is. But does it make a difference, do you think, in selling your book? I've always wondered, you know, because I get blurbs too. You know, I get people to write, blurbs for my books, and I'm always wondering if it does make a difference.
I think it does. I just got word from our publisher a day or two ago that we're going for a second printing of the book. And,
great!
And having that. The true crime genre is a very popular genre, and anyone who picks up the book in a bookstore and sees will recognize Bugliosi's name instantly because of his fame from Helter Skelter.
Right.
And a recommendation from him means something, I think.
Right. That's very true. So how did this book come about? How did you and Charles get together?
Well, Charles and I, Charles is a career prosecutor. He served 27 years mostly as a prosecutor for the Attorney General of New Jersey, and he had the duty of going around the state trying high-profile cases for one reason or another. And he also, from time to time, would be installed as an acting county prosecutor. New Jersey has 21 counties, each headed by a prosecutor who is the chief law enforcement officer. Well, in 1995, Charlie became the acting county prosecutor in Bergen County, which is in northeastern New Jersey. And he needed someone to help run his office, and I had served in that office years before, and someone recommended me. We got together and we hit it off right away, and he hired me as his number three in command, and we developed a friendship. I was his office manager and also tried cases too. We developed a friendship, and after we both left the office in 2000, Charlie approached me. He knew I had written a couple of books and many newspaper and magazine articles, and he said, "Rich, I've got this case file, and I want you to take a look at it because I'd like you to do co-author this book with me about the Reldon case." I had heard about the Reldon case, of course, and Charlie has the distinction of having been the prosecutor who actually tried the third of three murder trials involving Reldon, and who finally put him away for good after two previous prosecutions had failed. And in that prosecution, Charlie saved all of his files, literally thousands of pages of original source materials, laboratory reports, witness statements, transcripts, etc. So I said, "All right, Charlie." I mean, I wasn't that anxious. I hadn't written in the true crime genre before, even though I was a prosecutor myself. Right. But I said, "All right, Charlie, out of friendship, I'll take a look at it." Well, I was blown away after I started reading these files. They literally occupied six large boxes of paperwork, and it took me a couple of months to go through it, but I was sold, and I said, "Charlie, we've got to tell this story together," and the result was The Charmer.
Right. What attracted you to the story? What made you think that this could be a really good read and a good book for the public?
There were so many unusual circumstances about the case. One of those is in the subtitle, where I characterize Robert Reldon as a millionaire.
Right.
He came from a well-to-do family, but his aunt, a woman by the name of Lillian Booth, quite famous in the New York, New Jersey area as a philanthropist, his aunt had married an IBM heir, someone who inherited a lot of IBM stock in the 1940s. And when he died about 10 years later, she inherited $50 million, this woman, Lillian Booth. And she was Robert Reldon's mother's sister, so it was Reldon's aunt. And Lillian Booth showered favors not only on Reldon, but her other nieces and nephews. She didn't have children of her own. Well, anyway, after Reldon is convicted of these murders, or after he's indicted for the murders, rather, he's up in prison, and he hatches a plot to have his aunt killed by a hitman. Arranges to have a hitman visit him in prison during visiting hours, and he plots with this guy to have his aunt killed in her northern New Jersey home. The prosecutors got wind of this scheme and substituted an undercover detective as the hitman, and had Reldon on tape that plotting to murder his aunt so that his mother could inherit her share of her fortune, and his mother obviously would give it to Reldon too.
But his mother didn't know anything about this, right?
No, mother didn't know anything about it. Anyway, they get him on tape with this scheme. He's prosecuted for the conspiracy to murder his aunt, and his aunt actually testifies in his favor, saying that my Bobby, that's what she called him, my Bobby didn't really mean it. He couldn't have meant it. And he was convicted of the conspiracy. But when the aunt died in 2007, she actually left him a trust fund of $8.9 million.
Oh, wow.
So Reldon became the richest man in the New Jersey prison system and had this trust fund.
She also attended his trial, right, which was incredible.
She attended his trial and testified in his behalf, yes.
Right. And she was fully aware of all the facts about him setting up the hit on her.
The prosecutors played the tape that the undercover detective made of Reldon actually in his own voice plotting this scheme. But, see, that's one of the reasons why we came up with the title for this book, The Charmer, because Reldon had this effect not only on his female victims, but also on jurors, on psychiatrists and psychologists that he came into contact with, on just about anyone he came into contact with. He had this wonderful non-threatening demeanor. He was a handsome guy.
Right.
The cover of the book.
I'm just gonna mention. I wish our viewers could see the book. I mean, you know, when you think of Charles Manson, he looks like a killer. And you look at this guy here, he looks like, you know, president of General Motors or a leading congressman, you know, or a movie star. He's just, I mean, you don't look at this, you know, he's a monster as much as Charles Manson is, right?
Yeah, exactly. That cover was taken when he was arrested for the rape of a New Jersey housewife. And if I could just give you a little bit of insight on how he got mm-hmm. close to his victims. He mm-hmm. followed this housewife home. She was driving home from delivering something to her mother in a nearby town. He followed her home, picked her out at random. She sees her go into her home, and then he almost instantaneously comes up with a ruse, a subterfuge to gain entry to the house. He had a cleaning bag, dry cleaning bag, in the back mm-hmm. of his car. He slips it over his shoulder, rings the doorbell, and poses as a dry cleaning delivery man at the wrong address.
Right.
He asked the woman if he could use her phone. This was in the days before cell phones. If mm-hmm. he could use her phone to call his boss to get the correct address, and uses that ruse to gain entry. She sees a clean-cut young man outside her, and is not really frightened or put on guard. Mm-hmm. Well, that's how he got close to probably a dozen or more victims.
Wow. On that, you write that he grew up as a young man with an overinflated sense of entitlement and a dark side that enjoyed preying on women. Was this evident? I mean, this budding monster when he was growing up.
It sure was. He was a junior in high school when he committed his first offense, 16 and a half years old. He lived right across the Hudson River from New York City, and he went over to New York City and accosted a middle-aged woman in the lobby of her apartment building. Mm-hmm. She allowed him to get close. He put a chokehold on her, ripped her pocketbook away, didn't assault her sexually, but ripped her pocketbook and ran off at 16 and a half. He was caught shortly thereafter and given a slap on the wrist. It was his first offense, and with juveniles, even with this violent behavior mm-hmm. of his, the chokehold, nevertheless, he was given a slap on the wrist, sent it back mm-hmm. across the Hudson River by the New York judge, and told, do no more, I mean, with no requirements of counseling or anything like that, and that began his life of crime.
Well, that's what you write about. You know, you write that he got off time and again. Do you think this gave him a sense of entitlement as far as being a monster, in the sense that you write that, you know, his crimes gradually increased in violence, you know, from assault, burglary, rape to murder, right?
So you think
that did you think that because he's let off that this enhanced and encouraged a sense of entitlement as
absolutely no question about it, Ron, because the he felt that he could beat the system.
Mm-hmm.
The first three trials that he mm-hmm. underwent as a defendant, three of them ended in hung juries. Three of them failed to convict with overwhelming evidence, eyewitnesses and everything else, overwhelming evidence. Three of them failed to convict him. He would appear at trial dressed to the nines in a wonderfully appropriate suit. His family was behind him, mother, father, sister, aunt were behind him, showing their support. And
right.
juries could just not believe that this young man could have committed the horrendous crimes that were being alleged right. against him. And one or more of them, as you know, it only takes one
right.
juror to get a hung jury. And he just felt that he was
right.
able to beat the system.
Right, so he would hang the jury, right? You know, you'd have 11 people convinced that he was guilty, and then have that one person.
Murder trial, yes, exactly. In his first murder trial, this really gives you insight into it. Mm-hmm. His first murder trial for a double homicide of two mm-hmm. young women whom he abducted and raped and dumped their nude bodies across mm-hmm. the state line in New York State. His first murder trial, the jury comes back hung, a mistrial is declared, and the prosecutor's office later finds out that one of the jurors, a female, was in love with Reldon, was infatuated by him, and no matter what the evidence was, no matter how convincing her fellow jurors were that this was, a very convincing case of guilt, she would not vote, and the jurors had no choice but to come back and say, we're hopelessly deadlocked. Now, the reason the prosecutors found out about that, one of the jurors was related to someone in the prosecutor's office. It was disclosed to the defense, and they still left this person on the jury.
Right.
And after the trial was over, not during the trial, but after the trial was over, she told her relative in the prosecutor's office all about it. So we know for a fact that a woman on the jury was infatuated with him, and he had to go, the state had to go through their paces all over again to get try to get a conviction the next time out.
Right. Yeah. Willie?
Yeah. We have a photo that we're looking at, I am at least, of Robert Reldon when he graduated high school, 1958. Looks like a quintessential nice guy. Now, do you think his counselors in high school recognize his behavior? And why do you think they failed to really jump on this thing?
That's a good question, Richard, because in the book you write about the early warning signs, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
That gave. So to talk about Willie's question in light of that, to give us some background on this guy and how he got away with this stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what the counselors in his high school were able to do. I happen to sit on the Board of Education in my hometown right now in Ramsey, New Jersey, in Bergen County, the same place where these murders took place. And schools are very limited in what they can do for behavior that occurs outside the school setting. They're just very limited under New Jersey law as to what they can do. But nevertheless, when Reldon was committing these offenses as a juvenile and as a high school student, both a junior and a senior in this high school, the courts started ordering him to be examined by psychiatrists and started ordering him to undergo psychiatric treatment as a condition of a light sentence, a probationary sentence. Mm-hmm. And he would go to one or two meetings with a psychiatrist. They diagnosed him as having a strong aversion to women, hating his mother and hating his aunt, and they suggested that he had what they called a Don Juan complex. Not certain about his sexual proclivities or sexual orientation, and then wanting to take it out on women. But in any event, he would go to one or two of these mandated psychiatric sessions and then stop going. And as you fellows know, with your background in criminal justice, the probation departments and the social workers in the system are so overworked, with one worker maybe having 300 or 400 files to follow up on. He just fell through the cracks, and they never violated his probation, and he just continued committing crimes.
Right. Well, this talk about hating women and bad, but you look at his father and mother were pretty normal, right? He wasn't beaten. His aunt, Miss Booth, loved him, adored him. He was spoiled as a kid. How do you explain that? I mean, he had everything going for him, including his personality, his good looks, and that's what's really baffling about this story as you read it in your really great book.
He certainly had this animosity toward his mother and his aunt. I think toward his mother, she doted on him. She actually spoiled him, and I think it was contempt for her. He had a yearning to be closer to his father. I don't know exactly what their relationship was, and because no one in the family actually talked to us about that.
Right.
We interviewed dozens of witnesses, but no one in the Reldon family. They were pretty close-mouthed about what went on. So we didn't have that inside information. But in any event, he felt this antagonism probably buried because he wanted to keep getting gifts from his aunt. She gave him a Volkswagen convertible when he got out of prison one time. he had this animosity toward his aunt because he felt that she had all these millions of dollars and she was being miserly in the amounts that she would give him. She would just give him $1,000 here and there, and instead of the more money that he had he craved.
You know, it sounds like this guy was just born bad. I mean, some people, no matter what happens in life, whether they're treated bad or treated well, are just bad.
He not only had this charming effect on his victims to get close to him and on jurors when he was up against the prosecution and trials, but he had the effect on his family, too. His sister is still his strongest supporter. His mother and father are both deceased now, but they... They went to their graves believing that their son was innocent of all these crimes. They just didn't believe the evidence.
Right. We should tell our listeners that he's about, what, 70 now?
He's 72 now.
Yes, 72
now. And he's
now?
Serving a life term in prison. He was denied parole in 2010 and will probably come up in another year or two for another parole hearing. The father and mother of one of his murder victims... are in their 80s and they're still around. That's another story.
We'll talk about that a little bit later. We're going to take a little break here and talk about your book, where our listeners can get your great book. Willie, let's take a station break, please.
You bet. What a great interview. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and Will Hareb. Our very special guest tonight is Richard Moody, author of The Charmer. Now back to Ron and Richard Moody.
Right. The full title is The True Story of Robert Reldon, Rapist, Murderer, and Millionaire, and the Woman Who Fell Victim to His Allure. And the co-author is Charles Buckley, and the publisher is Titletown Publishing. And what's the best way for our listeners to get their hands on your book?
Well, I know you have listeners worldwide, and,
right.
and the book is available in both print and electronic editions at Amazon.com, also BarnesandNoble.com, and at all Barnes and Noble bookstores.
Right. Do you have a website that they can go to?
Yeah, TitletownPublishing.com. TitletownPublishing.com. That's the website of our publisher.
Right. And title is spelled T-I-T-L-E. And you got Twitter and Facebook? Or Mr. Buckley?
I'm on Facebook, yes, Richard Moody. I'm on Facebook. I don't do Twitter because I can't say what I want to say in 140 characters or less.
Well, you're a lawyer.
I am a lawyer. Right.
Right. You need volumes, right? And that sort of thing. Let's get back to our discussion of the case of Robert Weldon. You know, we were talking generally about him, and this is add some human faces to this story. He was convicted first in 1967, is that correct, raping a woman in Teaneck?
Yes, that's Teaneck housewife episode I told you about.
Right, and he served 3 years. How many years did he get?
He was sentenced after that conviction. Incidentally, the first time he went to trial for that rape, it was one of his hung juries. And the second time he went, he had a better prosecutor involved and was convicted and was sentenced to an indeterminate term in prison of up to 30 years. In other words, the maximum he could do would be 30 years. But with sex offenders in New Jersey at the time, they were taking the approach that we've got to diagnose the problem and see how we can rehabilitate these folks and maybe return them as productive members of society. So he was sentenced to prison and went through the sex offenders diagnostic and treatment program and came under the sway of a prison psychologist by the name of William Prendergast. And Prendergast was another one of these folks who was absolutely charmed by Robert Reldon. Mm-hmm. Prendergast began writing glowing reports about how receptive Reldon was to treatment and rehabilitation and how if he were granted parole, he would become a model parolee for the rest of his life and would be productive, etc. And finally, after getting 3 years of these reports, the New Jersey Parole Board said, okay, we're going to let him go based on Mr. Prendergast's recommendation. And within 5 months, he had assaulted another woman.
Right. He pulled a knife on a woman in a hospital parking lot after a therapy session, believe it or not, right?
Yes. He actually followed her to her home, coming out of the hospital parking lot, followed her to her home and accosted her in her garage.
Right. And what happened then? Did he go back to therapy? I hope he didn't go back to therapy.
No, he didn't go back to the Diagnostic Treatment Center. He was sentenced to a new term, but to run concurrently with the term that he had already been sentenced on. So he ended up serving another 4 years. Remember, he was initially sentenced to 30 years, served
right.
only three, sentenced to another indeterminate term for this offense
mm-hmm.
To run concurrent with the other. So he serves another 4 years, a total of 7 years imprisonment for a vicious rape and a vicious attempted rape with a knife at the woman's throat.
Right. Well, you know, he seems like a charmer, all right, but he seems kind of stupid and kind of dumb. I mean, the way he does things, it's like a guy that feels entitled. You know,
I wouldn't characterize him as dumb. He's highly intelligent. I would bet that his IQ is way above average. But a lot of the psychiatrists, Ron, who interviewed him and who were participating mm-hmm. in his treatment for periods of time, said that he had almost a wish to be caught. So mm-hmm. so a lot of the ways in which he did these crimes was dumb in that respect. And mm-hmm. Speaking as a former career prosecutor, thank God for the fact mm-hmm. that a lot of the criminals make lots of mistakes.
Right, right. They're not as smart as public think they are. I know that because I've interviewed lots of them and I've written about
yes.
them on that, because they keep making the same mistakes all, you know, all the time and don't learn from the past. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, getting parole. So he's granted parole again. And then a little more, 4 months after, what happens?
Well,
in October 1975.
After he goes back to prison, he comes under the wing of Prendergast again. And Prendergast, remember a television show that David Frost hosted where he interviewed people?
Oh, Reldon, that was real famous, yeah.
Yeah, Reldon, one of Frost's interviewees was Richard Nixon, but Reldon, they did a movie about it, but Reldon actually
right.
gets interviewed by David Frost just before he's let out of prison in May of 75, and the theme of Frost's show was sex offenders who have been rehabilitated and who are now productive members of society. Well, the following month, in late May of 75, Reldon gets paroled once again. He marries a girl who he had taken up with during one of his brief stays out of prison. And within 5 months, he abducts and murders two more women.
Wow, wow. And I understand in that interview, Reldon made a plea to the audience to please understand sex offenders.
Exactly right.
I mean, he said that with a straight face, right?
Yes.
That's amazing. So he these two poor girls, Susan Haynes, right, of Haworth, and Susan Reeve of Demarest.
Yeah,
Susan Haynes
was a British nurse
right.
here in the States just a few months. Her husband worked for British Leyland Motors, and she goes out, and Reldon again selects her randomly and follows her home and
mm-hmm.
comes up with a subterfuge to get her close to him, puts her in a chokehold or some other way
right.
to subdue her, throws her in his car, his vehicle. We later find hair samples
mm-hmm.
in the vehicle that matched hers,
mm-hmm.
and is off with her. We don't know where he raped and killed her, but he did do that, dispose of her body. 8 days later, before this first body is found, he abducts another young girl, Susan Reeve, from Demarest, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
She's a 22-year-old college graduate working in New York City, takes
mm-hmm.
a commuter bus home to her home about across the river and is abducted on her way home to
mm-hmm.
a short walk from the bus stop.
Wow. And again, the police questioned Reldon, right? And they announced that he wasn't a suspect.
They did call him in when these two women were abducted. They called him in to interview him. They knew that he was a sex offender. They knew he had
mm-hmm.
just been released on parole, and it was part of the web that they were casting, the
mm-hmm.
net that they were casting, in order to try to find some clues pertaining to this. And they, a very astute detective interviewed Reldon, got him on record as to a lot of lies, and that interview was later very instrumental in the trials that took place. But no, they didn't announce that he was a suspect, or that he was not. They didn't announce that he was not a suspect, but they didn't. Right away, the detective knew that he was someone of interest, as they say today, a person of interest.
Right. But, so did they continue to investigate him?
They continued to investigate him. Soon after he had that interview, he panicked because he had taken the engagement ring off of the finger of the, his first victim, Susan Haynes, and sold it in New York City at Macy's department store. And after he was called in for that interview, he went back to Macy's and made a big stink about getting the ring back because he didn't want evidence connected to him to be in the hands of someone who might read about the case. And in any event, he got the ring back. But later, when his name appeared in the newspapers for conducting a burglary, he did a couple of daylight burglaries to sort of throw the police off the scent after he knew he was being thought of as a prime suspect. The Macy's folks contacted the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office, and that sort of solidified the idea that Reldon was the guy, because the ring was a very distinctive engagement ring. They got it was sold at Harrods department store in London, and they were able to match it up to the ring that this woman had had worn.
Right. Well, you're telling telling us about all the help he got. Talk about the Gloucester detective who failed to disclose that he had seen Weldon's car in Miss Haynes' driveway.
That's really. You know, as a career prosecutor, you never want to see a police officer involved in extreme dereliction of duty. Police officers can make mistakes, but this was so extreme.
Did he make a mistake, or was it intentional?
It was intentional. On the day that Susan Haynes was abducted, that would be October 6, 1975, a Closter police detective, Closter was the town right next door to Haworth, New Jersey, where the Haynes woman lived, but the Closter police detective was someplace where he shouldn't be. He was outside of his jurisdiction of Closter, and he was inspecting a job that his private company had done on the roads outside this woman's home in Haworth, New Jersey. Now, the Closter town fathers had allowed him to carry on this private business so long as he didn't do it during his working hours. So he knew that he was outside of his jurisdiction and really working at his private firm when he was supposed to be a police detective in Closter, New Jersey. And he saw this car in Susan Haynes' driveway, didn't know that it was connected to a crime at the time he first saw it.
Right.
But shortly thereafter, one of the burglaries that Reldon committed was in Closter, his town, and the car was impounded and was in his police impound lot within days of him having sighted it in the driveway of this missing woman. So he had to have connected that car owned by Reldon to the missing woman's abduction, because he saw it in his police station and he saw it in her driveway and he knew it. But he kept quiet about it for 4 years. He didn't say a word about it to anyone for 4 years because he feared that if the mayor and council of his town knew that he was in the position to see the car because he was violating their regulations, he would have suffered career detriment probably.
How did you find out about it?
I found out about it by going through the files that Charlie had saved and came across a sworn statement given by this police officer after he finally came forward 4 years later when it was too late to do the prosecution any good. This was after Reldon had already gotten that first hung jury. It was during the midst of his second trial, and it was just too late to put him on the witness stand because he had never been identified as a witness in that regard before, and it would have been ludicrous to put him forward now as a police officer who kept damaging evidence to himself for 4 years. He would have had no credibility with the jury.
The irony of this whole thing, didn't he become a police chief?
He became chief of his of his department is now retired and living comfortably
in
Florida.
That's incredible. Willie, let's take a quick break, and then we'll get back. We'll lead off with your question, okay?
You bet. You bet. Great interview at this time. We'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and Will Rib. Now back to Ron Chapsick and Richard Moody, author of The Charmer, for the remainder of the program. Well, I got a quick one, Richard. As a prosecutor, when prosecutors look at people like Reldon, who took up poetry, he won writing awards, he worked on a lawsuit that succeeded in making life more bearable for the mentally ill, he was active with the ministries, how do you prosecute this guy?
Well, perhaps your question is related to why do you deny him parole? He's 72 years old. Shouldn't he be given a chance again to enter society? And the answer to that, Will, is that Reldon is still lying about his responsibilities for these two murders. He was interviewed by the parole board when he last went up in 2009. He was denied in 2010, but he was interviewed by the parole board and really gave a cock and bull story about how at least Susan Reeve, I saw some of the information about his version of that event, Susan Reeve. He almost put Susan Reeve in the place of the aggressor in the encounter between the two and made it seem as if her death were accidental. In other words, admitting to some participation in it, but he really didn't mean it, which is really ludicrous. It was one of the reasons why I chose not to interview him for the book, because I knew that he would not be truthful. Anyway, the parole board concluded that he still is lying about his responsibility for these murders, and they concluded quite forcefully that if left out, even at age 72, if let out of prison, he would still be a threat to society, and they denied him parole.
Right. Do you think that's permanent? He'll die in prison?
I don't know, because his sister is very supportive of him. I know you want to get into how he was deprived of his inheritance, but his sister is still supplying him money, I think, for his lawyers, and he will keep making overtures to get out of prison. He just won an appeal and got a chance to show that he should be given another opportunity to apply for parole. The New Jersey Appellate Division gave him that opportunity, so he'll be coming up for parole. And these poor parents, Arthur and Susan Reeve, have to go through this difficult reliving of the events each time that happens. These murders occurred before the new penalty of life without possibility of parole came into being. He committed these murders. There was no death penalty in New Jersey at the time, and also no life without parole. So he keeps coming up. He still has the right to keep coming up for parole.
Right. Well, he did have, there were three trials. It was really tough putting him away. And he acted as his own lawyer in 1986, right, in the third trial?
In the third trial that Charlie Buckley prosecuted, yes, he acted as his
own lawyer. Well, how did he do? Did that have an impact? You know, because they always say you're a fool. You defend yourself, right? You have a fool for a client.
Yes, I read the entire transcript of that trial, and of course Charlie was there and had firsthand recollection of what occurred. He actually handled himself fairly well in questioning witnesses and trying to reach certain points, but you could tell, he was obviously an amateur. He asked many questions. You know, one of the old saws about being a trial lawyer is, don't ask one question too many, where the answer, you achieved your point earlier, but you ask the next question and a ton of bricks falls down on you. Well, that happened a couple of times in the trial, and I interviewed one of the jurors in that third trial, and she gave me her opinion that he just talked too much and jurors were turned off by him. He was getting a little long in the tooth by the time that 1986 trial happened, so he didn't have that same degree of youthful charm that he had in his earlier trials.
Yeah, we talked last week about Breivik, the mass killer in Norway, And one of the theories about him, he was an extreme narcissist. And in some ways, Roaldon sounds like an extreme narcissist, right? That he could actually get up and defend himself and actually convince people that, you know, that he was innocent. That sounds like an extreme narcissist to me.
Absolutely.
On that. Now, we haven't got much time, and we could go on for another hour because this is so fascinating, but you're talking about depriving him of his inheritance. Can you summarize that, what happened? I know there were civil cases.
I can. After he received the inheritance in 2007, Arthur Reeve, the father of Susan Reeve, learned mm-hmm. about it. Arthur's down in Florida, retired. Mm-hmm. He's in his mid-80s. He learned about it and retained very good legal counsel in New Jersey, and they went after Roaldon to deprive him of the inheritance. This was a unique type of case because New Jersey law would only allow the parents to go after him for monetary loss, and Susan Reeve was just a new starting out in business and didn't have much of a monetary damage aspect of it. But they got some of the laws changed, and they were able to actually get a consent judgment against Roaldon for $10 million, effectively depriving him of his entire inheritance.
Wow.
I think Roaldon went along with it because he wanted to be able to get out of prison, and if he felt that if he consented to it, and it would be less of a threat.
Yeah, it's not like O.J. Simpson where they never got the money, even though they were sued for $30 million plus. You know, he was sued by one of the families on that.
And the parents, by the way, have donated the funds that they got from this lawsuit to their daughter's alma mater, a scholarship fund in her name.
Right on that. Well, you know, you're looking at this this case, and it seems like mistake after mistake after mistake. And you're, for me at least, it looks like the criminal justice system continually failed and embarrassed itself. What is your opinion?
I agree. There were many instances of too lenient plea bargains where he would have multiple offenses that he had committed, and prosecutors would allow him to plead guilty to less onerous offenses and dismiss the offenses that really showed his predilection to hurt women.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he did a home invasion where he had assaulted a woman with a tire iron, a woman who lived in the mm-hmm. house.
Right.
Well, they let him plead guilty to burglary and dismiss the assault, you know, as mm-hmm. part of a plea bargain. He got these lenient plea bargains time after time. This was in the 60s and 70s. I think the system has changed greatly, and I think prosecutors all over the country, all over the world, are more in tune with protecting victims and more in tune with victims' rights. So I think it's changed for the better.
Well, that's great, because when I was reading your book, I kept thinking, how many other guys out there like him? How many other monsters are there out there like him that are manipulating the criminal justice system and causing great damage to society, great harm?
Yes.
On that. Well, we got about two minutes or so. Are there any lessons to be drawn from this case? I mean, for criminal defense lawyers or criminal prosecutors, how do you look back at this case?
Well, I think there are lessons for the public. I mean, this is something that all of my friends in the profession who have read the book, prosecutors, investigators, think it's an amazing story. But it's also a tale for the public, too. Another blurb that we have on the book by Ken Oletta says this is a tale that you would not want to tell your children at night, but it says that you should not judge the substance of a person by the outward appearance of that person. You should be on guard in certain situations. And if I were a father of young girls, my girls are older now and know the ways of the world, but if I were a father of a young girl going to college or something like that, I'd buy this book and make sure they read it before they went off to college and learned a little bit about being on guard.
Right. I hope our listeners, our women out there, are listening to that, because I think that's wise advice. And as we finish up here, movie, of course. We all think movie, right?
I'm hoping that's something. I was listening to your success, Ken, about that. And actually, my publisher notified me last 2 weeks ago that a documentary, a made-for-television producer, of documentaries has expressed an interest, so we've forwarded some materials to that, and I'm hoping something comes to pass on
right.
that.
Right. Well, it's a great case study, right? I mean,
yes.
I mean, there's so many things that the public and the legal system can learn from it. So let's hope you have really great success, more success with your book. And like I said, it's a great read, and I recommend the book. Again, The Charmer, The True Story of Robert Weldon, Rapist, Murderer, and Millionaire, and The Woman Who Fell Victim to His Allure. It's on Amazon, bookstores. If you haven't got a copy, please go out and buy it. It's a great read. Willie and I both recommend it. And Richard Mudie, thank you for being on the show. And tell us about your next book when it comes out. We'd love to have you on the show.
I will. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being here. Thank you very much, Ron and Will.
Well, and I should mention one thing. Make it sure it's about crime if you want to get back on. don't talk about how to grow a business or how to make love, you know, in 10 easy ways or something like that, okay?
That's a deal.
Okay, then. Thank you, then. Willie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Yeah. You're really, really great. You're a great interview. Yeah. Now, I'll tell you, Ronnie, we have to thank our guest, Richard Mudie. It was a fascinating interview. We were delighted to have him on our broadcast. It's unfortunate that his co-author couldn't make it, but...
But he did a great job.
I think Mr. Mudie said it all. What did you learn about the program tonight?
Well, yeah, you know, I read the book, talked to... we talked with Richard, and I'm just amazed at the human capacity for depravity. I mean, this character, this guy makes Charles Manson look like an amateur. Of course, his crimes are the same. And I always can conclude that you're not alone, Willie.
Well, charming. They call me charming.
That's right.
That
they call you the charmer. How about you, Willie?
Well, you know what, Ronnie? I learned that Robert Weldon could have been a damn good politician, let me tell you. If he would have played his cards right, he took a wrong turn and became a cold-hearted psychopath with no conscience whatsoever.
Right.
Ronnie, didn't they call you the charmer in the East End burial? But they called you the charmer, didn't they?
Yeah, I think they did. But no, that's a long time ago, and I can't remember. That's my defense, okay?
Okay, many moons ago. We'll get back on that. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat History segment of the month. This day, 104 years ago, July the 26th, 1908, FBI founded. On July 26th, 1908, the Federal Bureau of Investigation is born when U.S. Attorney General Charles Bonaparte orders a group of newly hired federal investigators to report to Chief Examiner Stanley W. Finch of the Department of Justice. 1 year later, the Office of the Chief Examiner was renamed the Bureau of Investigation. The rest is history. Any comments, Ronnie?
Yeah, you know, growing up, I always thought Efren Zimbalist Jr. was the FBI director.
Well, I thought it was Robert Stack. He was the big guy.
No, well, you remember that show with Efren Zimbalist Jr. that ran from the mid-60s to early 70s?
Right. Yeah.
You know, he was, he looked like the perfect FBI guy. But, of course, we were stuck with J. Edgar Hoover. Anyways, that's history. By the way, Efren Zimbalist Jr. is still alive. He was born in 1918. So he's 93 years old. I thought he was long gone on that. Willie?
I hope he stays around for another 100 years. Now, just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for August the 2nd, where we'll have Howard Campbell in a command performance. Howard Campbell will discuss his best-selling book titled Drug War Zone, Frontline Dispatches from the Streets of El Paso and Juarez. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network, with Ron Chesick and yours truly, Will Rib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our broadcast Crime Beat programs, past programs, anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we would like to thank you for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about the program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chesick and myself, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.